I'd like now to welcome to the show Dennis Reinhartz. He's a historian, he's a professor emeritus at the University of Texas in Arlington, and he's co-curator of the exhibition Between the Lines, Culture and Cartography on the Road to Statehood. It's at the Governor's Gallery on the fourth floor of the Roundhouse right now, and it's up until the 4th of May. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, cartography, mapping. Why did people start mapping New Mexico? I mean, you've got maps back to the 16th century, and why did they do it and for whom?
Well, there are lots of reasons people historically map. Mapping goes back very far back in human history. In other words, people certainly drew before they could write, and they probably mapped before they could write. And the mapping develops as the need for it develops. So, in other words, first of all, to answer your question, it was to get some sort of idea of what you had, that is, what northern New Spain was like. And initially, it's just a big blank on a map. And eventually, as our exhibit shows, it sort of fills in. But there's also this idea that once you map it, you're establishing a good part of a claim to it. So, in other words, one of the reasons you map, and one of the reasons the Spanish certainly mapped up in this area as best they could at the time, was to establish claims to territory that they really had no physical presence in. So they just, added it to the map. It was their map. They did it. It's their territory. So that's another reason you map, is to claim. And ultimately, the claiming then comes to recording. In other words, the specifics of what you have and what you claim then are recorded on maps as well. So that's the original impetus for it. But eventually there are, as the exhibit shows, there are many other reasons. I mean, we've got all kinds of maps in there, dating, like you said, from the 16th century, but all the way into the 21st century. So,
I was thinking, I mean, there you have these first Spanish maps, and one thinks about the people who were here for centuries, if not millennia, beforehand, who never mapped. And the difference between the mapping mind and the non-mapping mind. So the native people here presumably knew how to get around pretty well.
Well, it's unfair to say that native peoples didn't map. They did. But we have several problems with native maps. One is their fragility, and that is they were made of materials that didn't last very well. Secondly, a lot of their mapping, as you alluded to, was mental. So in other words, we have all kinds of examples of mental mapping among native peoples. For example, among the Ojibwe up in the Great Lakes area, they used to do what was called star running. And they would run at night and knew exactly where they were going because they would go according to the stars.
Yeah.
Well, those star maps were in their minds. They weren't written down or anywhere. And also another problem we have is, since we don't have any translators available for us for the older native maps, we don't know what a map is. In other words, we could be looking at an artifact that clearly we say was made by an ancient people, but because we don't have anybody to tell us that's a map and how it works, it doesn't exist. No, the differences, one of the differences between European mapping and Native American mapping is conception of time and space, and that is they're very different. And secondly, the addition of progressive technology. In other words, from hand-drawn to eventually reproduced mechanically through various forms of printing, which, of course, Native Americans never get a chance to do.
Right, at least in this area.
Well, almost, the only example I can think of Native American mass reproduction is the Cherokee language. And that is when the Cherokee language was found or created, and it was created under Anglo occupation, if you will, but they actually printed it and had newspapers in it and so on and so forth. But usually Native American culture isn't mass-produced,
So what were the tools that the early Spanish maps or cartographers used for mapping?
Well, they basically used what were navigational instruments, that is, to find one's way on sea, and they brought that on land and eventually modified some of that, which then becomes the basis for surveying equipment and so on. But early on, a lot of mapping in this part of the world and everywhere in the New World by Europeans was done freehand. And it was based upon what the observers saw, but initially also what Native Americans told them. And this is where we get into this problem of time and space. To a Native American and to as sort of a Native people anywhere, distance is far. Anything is far. So in other words, you ask, I remember I used to, when I was doing a postdoctorate in Yugoslavia, I was taking a walk in the hills outside of Belgrade, and I was trying to find this one little village. And I said to this peasant working the field, I asked him, you know, where was it? And he told me, and I said, is it far? And he goes, oh, yeah, real far, real far. Well, it was over the hill. It was about less than a mile. But because it wasn't his village, because he wasn't associated, it was far. Well,
it reminds me of that map of the world that, from the point of view of New York, that came out in the 1980s, where everything centered around Manhattan.
Yeah, and that was the Great New Yorker cover at one point. Right. Yeah, it's a social commentary on how isolated New Yorkers are.
Right.
They can be among, I mean, even though they live at the center of the world, literally, they can be the most isolated people there are. In other words, they leave the island, they're lost.
Right.
Right. And again, one of the things maps do is tell us about social development at any given time. This obviously was a map meant to critique New Yorkers' attitudes, you know. But anyway, getting back to your question of mechanics of making a map. So ultimately, though, eventually, and we have this in the exhibit, there's a beautiful map by a man named LaFora, who was a captain in the Royal Spanish Corps of Engineers, which was founded in the early 18th century. And this is really the beginning of scientific mapping, because the engineers basically mapped only what they could measure, and hopefully measure several times over. In other words, that they could repeat the measurements and come out with the accuracy and so on. And that would then go on their maps. And ultimately, then the smaller maps are combined into larger ones. And in the process, a lot of hearsay information is wiped out or discarded, including Native American information, because it was no longer deemed accurate. There's also an ulterior motive, and that is the further you remove the Native Americans from the map, the better you have a chance of taking over their land and claiming it as your own. So in other words, by replacing Native American names with Spanish place names, you're literally taking the territory that was once theirs and making it yours. And that's part of how maps work in the case of imperialism and colonization.
One thing I was thinking of while looking at the maps in this show was that maps and borders are really made on paper rather than on the land. I mean, you've got straight lines that are cutting across mountains and valleys and ditches and so on, just in order to make it a straight line. And if you were in nature making those lines, they'd look more like watershed maps or in fact, some of the railroad maps actually follow more the terrain of nature.
Well, if you look at a map of the United States and you go from East Coast to West, you find in the East Coast, in the 13 colonies and the states along the East Coast and inland from them, and even in the Ohio Territory, natural boundaries are much more common, both for states but also for counties. But, for example, once you get into western Pennsylvania, they all of a sudden begin to straighten out, and you get your squares and you get your straight lines, your 90-degree angles. There's no such thing as a 90-degree angle in nature, you know, and so... And what you're seeing is the coming of the Enlightenment and Enlightenment science into play into the area of map making. And so from western Pennsylvania on west, you begin then to get the Enlightened surveys, the rational scientific survey. When you get to the far west, that is the southwest and the far west, and particularly a place like New Mexico, which achieved statehood so late, in relative terms.
Approximately 100
years
ago. Exactly 100 years ago.
And when it should have been about 150 years ago, you know, then you see in our state and you see in our surrounding states, I mean, that we've got basically rectangles. Well, we've got the boot heel, I mean, there are rectangular states, right? Yeah. Colorado is a rectangle.
Right, exactly. We're talking to Dennis Reinhartz about the exhibit Between the Lines, Culture and Cartography on the Road to Statehood. I think one of the pleasures of looking at maps is seeing the inaccuracies, like the map or maps in the show where California is an island.
Right.
And one wonders, I mean, they were using these tools and, as you say, doing it as scientifically as possible. How does that happen?
Well, first thing you have to realize about accuracy is that accuracy itself is historically relative. So in a case of a map, if a map does what it's supposed to do in its own time, regardless of what we judge it to be, it was accurate in its own time. Now, the idea of California as an island, that's a good example. That's based essentially on three sets of data. One is historical cultural. In other words, California itself was named after a mythical island. So the assumption, at least, is there that it should have been an island. Then you have people going up the Sea of Cortez early on, sailing up and up and up, and then they can no longer sail because of shallows. So they get on top of their masts, and they look over, and they say, well, beyond these shallows, there's deep water again, so it's an island. That never happened, but they thought that's what they saw. And then you just get false data, which people who said, yeah, I just sailed around California. So you don't get until the 18th century when Father Kino literally walked from California to Arizona and didn't have to get his feet wet, you know. And that's the sort of empirical proof, though people knew beforehand that was the case.
He walked from California to Arizona.
Yeah, he's the great founder of missions in the Southwest. And, yeah, he walked from California and should have come
across the Mojave Desert?
Yeah, should have come to the body of water and eventually ended up at Yuma and San Javier de Bach, which was his one of his missions in Arizona, and didn't cross. But he knew that ahead of time already because he was getting trade goods from California through the Indians into Arizona, and these Indians had no technology for sailing across large bodies of water. And so he already was sure of what he was doing, you know. But that's the kind of empirical proof you get. But a lot of the inaccuracies are also based upon the limitations of your equipment that you're measuring with, the limitations of your mathematics that you're calculating with. Obviously, once you get calculus as a going concern, you can be a lot more accurate and you do a lot more mathematical manipulation. It's also based on the fact that while latitude was very early determined, I mean, the ancients had latitude, longitude is harder to determine because longitude is factored through time. And you can't get accurate longitude till you get accurate timepieces, and that doesn't happen until the 18th century. And so a lot of the distortions you see on some of these maps are in part brought about by a longitude failure. In other words, they've got one coordinate that's accurate, but they don't have the other coordinate that's accurate. So when you place something based on a faulty coordinate system, eventually you get some of these distortions. A good example, and it's not in the show, but if you look at Florida, Florida takes a long time to take its real shape on a map. And that's primarily...
It's always there.
It's always there, but it's primarily a longitude problem.
Yeah.
And a somewhat smaller issue of the Everglades, because no one knows where land is and water begins. And so it's a little fuzzy in that way. But largely, there are longitude issues. So again, until these Spanish engineers come to work in this part of the world, and then eventually their work's inherited by Mexican and American engineers, and you get the determination of longitude for the first time really accurately, which is in the 1770s, until then, you know, you've got a basic issue of coordinates.
Now, the maps, for you, I imagine as a historian, especially tell the story of ever-changing borders.
Right.
And so you've got Texas in all kinds of shapes and New Mexico as a tube and then as square and
right.
all kinds of things. What were the pressures? I mean, how did these borders keep changing?
Well, see, first part of the problem is that what is New Mexico was a nothingness. In other words, it was out there, but there was nothing really to distinguish it. There wasn't even, for example, a Grand Canyon, you know, which, in fact, most early explorers saw as an impediment. It was just a big hole in the way, you know. And so it was hard to define. It's like trying to map the Sahara Desert or map an area of open ocean. In other words, there's nothing there to hang your map around, you know. Secondly, then the issue is that the French kept pushing their boundaries, especially on maps, further and further west. Louisiana grew very, very importantly into what is the Spanish or the area of New Spain. And then also even the Russians coming down across the Pacific on the Pacific coast began pushing down on Spanish claims, as did the English and so on and so forth. So that's a second factor.
So they would basically draw a line on a map further than...
Right.
what the political boundary really was and then be able to show it, say, this is ours.
Or they would say the boundary between New Spain and New France or Louisiana, New Spain is the Rio Grande. It wasn't, you know, but they'd say it. Or they'd say it's the Sabine River, right, which it was. But the Sabine then kept moving a little more westward.
But, I mean, would it work? Does that technique work?
Well, unless you're in the area and you can literally sort of firmly establish your claims, which the Spanish really couldn't, because ultimately they are a small country with limited resources, even though they got wealthy real fast. And to control and deal with this very large territory in the north and its issues, and to settle it with a limited population was very difficult. And then you had the problem of the Indians, and, you know, the Southwest is characterized by having some very unruly Indian groups, Apaches, Comanches, Navajo, and so on, that made the area sort of hard to settle as well. So until you've got firm settlement on the ground, you can get away with it on paper. It's paper imperialism. I'm actually doing a presentation on that at the Historical Society meeting this year. And there'll be another paper on the same panel that's talking about Texas claims on maps to New Mexico. And by the way, the Texicans inherited that attitude from their Spanish and French predecessors.
Did you just say the Texicans?
Yeah.
What's a Texican?
A Texican is what Texans were originally called.
Ah.
Texican actually was what they were called at the Alamo, because they were very aware that their heritage was not only Anglo but Mexican, and so they became Texicans. After independence and statehood, they became Texians, eliminating the Mexican. And, of course, today it's Texan. But Texican is the word I've always used to reflect on the heritage of the state of Texas.
Very interesting.
And, in fact, I've been complimented by a lot of Texas historians who say that's the way we should do it. So.
Very interesting. Who knew? You knew. Well, let's talk about something else which is important, which is just the aesthetic dimensions of these maps. Mm-hmm. Some of them are beautiful. And even that very earliest map you have, which I think 1564 in this exhibition, has, I think, is it pictures of saints on the sides,
yeah,
or religious,
yeah, yeah,
icons on the side? And all through history, these are really beautiful objects.
Well, they are part of the wider aesthetic experience. In other words, whether they're hand-drawn or whether they're reproduced by woodblock printing or metal plate printing or whatever kind of printing, there are design factors involved. And just like in any work of art, design is a key element. There are also cultural factors. You mentioned the pictures of saints. Early on, of course, there's a lot of white space on maps. And so to make the map more attractive and more saleable, things were added to fill in the white space. So why not saints, for example? On the other hand, the map maker or the discoverer or explorer who provided the data for the map might have a patron that he wanted included on the map. Also, in some of the cases of early sea charts, the navigators who would sit up late at night plotting courses had these one-of-a-kind maps with all this empty space, so they just start doodling. In other words, it's a form of graffiti they used to put on maps. And these become expensive works of art today, much more expensive for the artistic value than for the cartographic value. And so you can get, the map becomes a sort of cultural document, as you point out, by the artistic aesthetic side.
There's a topographical map in the exhibition. When did topographical maps come into being, and how were they used? Who made them and bought them and so on?
Well, topographical maps are old. In other words, we have some really nice examples dating back to the Roman Empire. And the Romans used them primarily to, again, know their estates and the features of their estates, and then to prove legal ownership to those estates. And that's essentially a lot of what topographical maps are all about. But in the American experience, and the ones you're talking about, those, again, are a product of the late 18th, the beginnings in the late 18th and then through into the 19th century and the 20th century. That, again, is a product of scientific mapping. It's survey-based maps. It's also a product of government mapping, because a large consumer or a large entity that requires topographical mapping is government, whether it be local, county, state, or federal. So you get either Royal Engineers or U.S. Corps of Topographical Engineers who were founded in the early part of the 19th century, involved in this kind of thing. And so topographical mapping becomes important, particularly when it comes to the uses of government and then the uses of industry, such as railroads, for example, or mining, or ranching, and what have you.
Do you have a favorite map in this show?
I like them all. Obviously, I wouldn't have helped to pick the ones I didn't like or I didn't think were valuable. But I have two. One is the only unique map in there in the sense that it's a one-of-a-kind, and that's the LaFora map from 1778, which is a hand-drawn map by one of these Spanish engineers. And it's very colorful. It's one-of-a-kind. It's done on vellum, which is sheepskin. And it was made based on a lot of data collected on his very large expedition through this area. But it was made later on, I think, in its eloquent form as a presentation piece. And it's sort of right in the middle of the exhibit. That wasn't my doing. That was just the people who mounted the exhibit. And the other one I'm very fond of is this map, the Darling Survey map, which is a map in its full extent, goes over 30 feet long. But we only have one section of it because Darling carried out a survey. He was a civilian surveyor hired by the United States government, and he surveyed the line across the west that eventually in our part of the world becomes the boundary between Colorado Territory and New Mexico Territory. And not only is it a really wonderful job of surveying, but it's really a wonderfully done map. The colors and the design on it are just really incredible. And I came to cartography and maps first out of art and aesthetics. And here what we have is a very scientific, very accurate, very modern map, if you will. It's, in the 1870s, but yet it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful. It's the design is beautiful. It's the all work together to have the map do what it's supposed to do, and that is convey this line across the western United States.
I found myself wondering, because of course I grew up looking at maps. I have collected a few maps. I love maps and read maps. You can't even really practically buy a map anymore because everybody's using GPS, and I wonder if people will even appreciate them or know how to read them 25 years from now.
Well, in the geographical studies area or geographical profession, there is a sort of low-key civil war that goes on between the map users, the traditional map users, and the computer types. That's been going on since the evolution of computers. I remember years ago, I guess it was about 1980, I was out at the University of Illinois Chicago Center, and they were one of the first groups to put mapping onto a computer. And they had this map of Chicago that they could manipulate all around and take you down streets and through. And I asked, so you can do it. Big deal. What are you going to do with it, and why are you doing this? In other words, what's its value? And at that point in 1980-81, the answer was because we can. Now the answer is there are thousands of answers of what you can get out of a map like that. But you're still dealing with a map. In other words, whether it's on a computer or whether it's in your car, on the dashboard, net, it's still a matter, okay, the voice in your car says turn right here, turn left here, and so on and so forth, if you've got that kind of a system. But ultimately, you still have to be able to read the map. And, road maps, and that's why we have several of them in the exhibit, are some of the most ubiquitous, common types of maps that everybody is associated with.
Yeah, but, when you have a GPS, you're listening to it more than you're looking
Absolutely.
At it. And you wonder if that kind of bird's eye view, so to speak, of the land gets lost, and your mind starts thinking in a different way about space when you're not looking at paper maps anymore.
When you're not looking at relationships, in other words.
Yeah.
But you are. You're forming them. Again, we go back to this mental mapping. You are forming mental maps because we do not think in written form. We think in pictures. Human beings think in pictures. And if you're able to slow your thoughts down slow enough, you might actually get to see some of those pictures, right? But so you're still your mind is forming the maps based upon the descriptions. For example, if the thing tells you three blocks from now, turn left, you're visualizing in your mind three blocks. In other words, at least the time continuum that it will take you to get three blocks. But the real issue is that drawn maps, maps on paper or maps on plastic or whatever, might just eventually disappear and it all would be digital and data-based. And that, I think, will be the poor for, just the way we would be the poor for when if books ever disappear.
Exactly.
I mean, all these tablets that are appearing, I think is fine, but I'm old enough to appreciate books more. And to bring up your issue, when will the day come when we're no longer reading off these computers, but the computers are reading to us?
Well, and there's I have some disks of things that I wrote when I was 25 on my computer, and the disks don't work on any computer, and the program that opens them doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So that information is essentially lost.
Yeah, unless you keep updating it with each new system that arrives.
Unless you keep doing that, which I certainly didn't, and which presumably many people didn't. And if the archaeologists of the year 4000 are looking for our information, paper may just last longer than...
Well, I got rid of my first computer, which was a DOS machine, when I no longer could find a printer that could communicate with it. So in other words, I could still read the stuff on the screen and input stuff on the screen, but there were no longer any printers around that could talk to the computer. And that's kind of what happens. But I think you're right. There's also this doomsday scenario of a great sunspot that will wipe out all electronic data, which I'm not sure can happen, but the issue is...
We shall see.
The issue is, yeah, in other words, if we digitize some of these wonderful old maps that are in the exhibit, sure, we've done that, and they'll eventually appear online through the Chavez Library and through Palacio, I think, El Palacio. But ultimately, there is also the issue of holding the map and what you learn from that. For example, that La Fora map I mentioned. If you touch it, it gives you a whole new world because it's made not of paper, but it's made of this wonderful material, vellum, which is in the right kinds of climates, which is not ours. It can last forever. In very dry climates, it shatters, and in very wet climates, it goes to chewing gum. You know, but in normal humidity, it goes on forever.
The exhibit is called Between the Lines, Culture and Cartography on the Road to Statehood. Dennis Reinhartz is historian, professor emeritus at the University of Texas in Arlington, and co-curator of the exhibit, which is at the Governor's Gallery on the fourth floor of the Roundhouse here in Santa Fe until the 4th of May. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back with Maggie McNabb in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Maggie McNabb. She is a designer, educator, and author. Her new book is called Design by Nature, Using Universal Forms and Principles in Design. And she's going to be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Friday the 13th of January at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a book, I mean, I guess it's for designers and students of design and so on, and I'm certainly not that, but I found it absolutely fascinating and quite useful because it helps you to understand, helps anybody to understand the visual world in terms of nature. Mm-hmm. You growing up here in New Mexico, nature was really your starting point, and for you, art is really grounded in natural forms.
Yes, exactly. I was also really fortunate in the fact that I had a father and both parents who were very involved in nature, interested in nature, and who both happened to be teachers. So my father was an architect for John Gamim, and he taught me basic universal principles and took me. He taught me through doing. It wasn't like sitting in a classroom. And I think children are very experientially oriented. And that's really, really important. And I find it with my students, too, because I typically teach people in their late teens, early 20s. and hands-on is just absolutely essential to understand. And what better to be hands-on with than the world that surrounds you, because we're so compartmentalized away from it, and yet you can't separate yourself from nature. We are nature, and we start to really wreak havoc when we begin to do that, as we're experiencing now in the modern world.
There are elements of nature that you talk about in the book, and I mean everything from motion to shapes and symmetries and some of the forms found in nature. There are also ideas of economy and simplicity, and nature teaches us those, I suppose, through the process of evolution, in which the simplest and most efficient design was the most likely to survive.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and what I found are the common principles in design are elegance, balance, and meaning. Because we're human beings that we're storytellers. We always have been storytellers, because consciousness is so much a piece of what it is to be human. It's very, very important that we're able to create relationships, understand relationships, and then recreate those relationships. And when you base those relationships on things that have worked for millennia in nature, you know you're working with sound principles that are universal. So they translate anywhere, any culture, any era, any time. And they're very, very workable, and they're also common to all design disciplines. I mean, I always say that the first profession is not what we've been told. The oldest profession is design. It's what human beings do, because we have consciousness to think of things that don't exist right in this moment, but we're able to be inspired and create and then find a way to put a result into the world that actually demonstrates the idea and makes it real. So that can be anything from designed communications that get across a concept to a building you walk into, to a satellite we send out into outer space. So design is the fundamental ability that all human beings have.
Looking at your book, and it's very richly illustrated with designs, both from wonderful designers and from art and from nature and from all different colors, all different cultures, I felt so often looking at these pictures a kind of joy inside of myself and a sense of beauty and mystery. What is the relationship between nature, beauty, and that kind of happiness that you must also feel when you're, for example, choosing things for this book?
Well, you know, I think I have a passion for creative problem solving, which my background was always to draw. I learned that from my father. He was always an artist and passed that on to me. But I really wanted to create something beyond or besides personal art for myself. I wanted to create things that actually solved problems for people. And being creative with that is how I found to do it. And nature is just the place where I've been able to source, figuring out on my own, because I wasn't formally educated in a lot of higher learning institutions. I had a father who taught me. I had hands-on experience. I've traveled a lot. I started my business when I was 25, 30 years ago. So it's just something I have learned by doing. And so this is something that I try and put my students in, whenever I'm in a situation of doing workshops or teaching classes, to have people do it hands-on with me.
You talk about the creative process, and part of the creative process is letting go and going to a way of thinking or a way of solving problems that is, I can't control this problem, which seems
right.
Almost like a paradox.
It is. It's counterintuitive, and it's exactly what we're not taught in today or trained in today's culture. But being aware of your intuitive knowledge, which we come into the world fully formed. We come into the world with everything we need. All we have to do is unfold to the experience that occurs around us through the process of living. And to not understand the value, or really honor the value of what it is to have spontaneity, to intuitively pursue things that feel correct for you, instead of staying within the boundaries that we're told are the correct boundaries for us, I think is one of the issues we're dealing with right now. We have a lot of unhappy people that are doing things that are really not the right fit for them. My sense and what I did with my kids was when they showed an interest in something, I did what I could to support that because it was just their own spirit unfolding into the world in a physical reality and finding a way to match up what they've come into the world with and be able to contribute to it by letting it unfold in a way that it should happen. So that's what I try to get across in this book, is, and that's why there's exercises in this book, so that people can do some things hands-on and they can gravitate to the things that speak to them. There's a reason our soul tells us when something is right, when it feels right. It is right. I mean, it's so clear. And when you look at some of the shapes in nature, or some of the patterns in nature, it's very clear what the energy is doing. For instance, the branching pattern in a tree, that's one of the most common patterns in the universe and in the world in particular. And we see it typically in plants, but it's also in river tributaries. It's in our nervous system. And it is energy moving from one place to another place with distribution points. It looks exactly like what it does. And when you really pay attention to what's around you and you're able to see some of the simplest stuff that I think we miss it because it's so obvious. It's like that thing of not being conscious of breathing. We do it in, out every moment of our lives, but we're not aware of it because it's just a part of processing the world and being part of the world. Well, interpreting everything around us through our senses is also that kind of situation. So what this book is teaching is how to pay attention to these subtleties. There's so much richness in subtlety and so much richness in being able to be spontaneous. That's when creativity can really shine through. And yes, it's unexpected and you don't know what you're going to get, but there are so many gems that come out of that rather than trying to manage what the end result is. And, you know, it's this is a style that's appropriate for doing certain things. You know, I'm not going to recommend you do this in every situation in your life, obviously. But when you're doing something that's creative, these are sound approaches to doing it with. Trust your intuition. Allow yourself to be spontaneous. I have an exercise in the book where you focus on one particular sense when you go out in nature, and you design around that sense alone as much as possible. So it's not just sight. It's also hearing. It's also the way the air feels on your skin. It's you focus on those things and then you find a way to express that. However it fits for you to express that. There's no right or wrong way to do it, you know.
We're talking to Maggie McNabb about her book, Designed by Nature. You talked about the branching pattern in your book. You also talk about the meandering pattern, which is the way that rivers flow and which is the way that people walk. And what's so interesting about, I mean, we are nature, we perceive nature. I would make a case that nature is more beautiful than anything that people can possibly create, and yet we see it better when people represent it and when people make art out of it. Mm-hmm. And I never thought about the meandering pattern as a form of art until you said that in your book, and there's so many insights like that.
Yeah. I think when we create a design or a piece of artwork or something that is human-generated, it's focusing on a specific piece, and maybe it helps clarify a relationship better in the way the artist or the designer perceives it that makes it clear to others. And this is one of the things that we really love about art and we love about good design, is it's bringing those invisible relationships to the forefront so they become more tangible to us. They become more tactile. They're experiential at that point, and they're not just happening in the subconscious. I mean, I say if you've got consciousness, you know, go ahead and use it. Find a way to pull up that stuff that's down in there and bring it up here and then use it in the world.
Toward the beginning of the book, you compare something called wabi-sabi with grunge. What are those two aesthetics? What are those two sets of meanings and how they're expressed?
Well, wabi-sabi is an Asian aesthetic, specifically from Japan, that is an acknowledgement of the beauty in things just as they are. If they're in an unfinished state, if they're in a state of deterioration, if they're in a state of chaos, it's an appreciation that everything that occurs in the world is involved in whatever its process is in the moment, and it's worthwhile because it is a piece of the overall process. So that's a very Asian aesthetic. It's an Eastern sensibility that people don't typically have in Western culture, although with the internet now, things are changing because there's so much merging of cultural tastes and the analogy I have of the world is like the two hemispheres of the brain. You've got the left side of the brain that is more linearly connected, that does more processing, that is involved with problem solving on a very sequential kind of a level. And then you've got the right side of the brain that I make analogous to the Eastern hemisphere of the world, that is more of a spontaneous kind of an unfolding as it does, that's not managed, it's appreciated for what it is. And, you know, it's not that one is better than the other or works any more efficiently than the other. They're both used together. They should be used together.
I was going to say, they can't live without each other.
That's right. I mean, we need both sides of our brain. And the more Western approach with grunge is, it's more of a reactive response to things not working very well in certain ways. So the punk response, the surfer response, the grunge response to things has come about by being reactive instead of just being in the presence of something as it is. So it's very much following along the line of Western culture's sort of sequential responsiveness, reactive responsiveness. And it fits perfectly with who we are in this culture.
So you're a designer, and people come to you with a problem. Like they need a logo, or they need a design, or they need to represent themselves in some way. Mm-hmm. And so they are perhaps coming from a business perspective, and yet you're grounded in nature. So I'm looking at your book, and you're thinking about spirals and squares and the dynamics of nature and waves and things like that. And then you're looking at somebody who's got a startup business and they need a logo. I mean, how do you bring together this person and their need with this kind of depth of beauty and nature and design that you're bringing to them?
Yeah. Well, the thing about nature is it is the universal language. We all speak it, we all know it, and we're all fluent in it, even though we're not all completely comfortable with saying we understand it that well, but we intuitively know it. We have to exist in this plane. You know, we are nature. It comes from the inside out in us. You know, every embryo on that point starts as a point, as a seed, as an egg, and unfurls in a spiral motion. This is moving from the inside out, and every creature in the world does it. But in the case of my own clients, I mean, I'm in the business of communicating. So what would make better sense than using a language that everyone universally speaks? And particularly in the global world that we're in right now, with so many people on the internet, with people from who knows what countries visiting, you don't want your design to be culturally specific. I mean, unless you're just narrowing it purposefully that way. I mean, most clients of mine would want to have a universal perception. And it, for me, started intuitively as a designer. I didn't plan to have this whole nature perspective. But what happened was, early on in my work in 1983, I won the first place award from the American Advertising Federation for logo design in the United States. This is way before the internet. I was a little, small, young designer in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I had a design that went all the way to the top in the United States, beyond all of the big ad agencies at that time. And I just continued to have logos that would resonate that way with people. And UNM at one point began to ask me to teach, so I began teaching there in the mid-90s. And the teaching process is what taught me what it was I was doing.
You were just doing it.
Good designers do this intuitively, and all humans do it intuitively. So I really learned more specifically. You know, I started off on the right foot with having this kind of introduction to nature from a really young age, but not in specifics like, well, the spiral is doing this kind of energy, or the circle represents this in all cultures. You know, that That kind of thing came later. And it came through my love of science. I mean, my dad got me onto microscopes when I was a little kid, 8 or 9 years old. And I began to see these self-similar scaling. Here we are in, you know, a city that's got the Santa Fe Institute and a lot of really fascinating theoretical physicists. And my dad read me science fiction when I was a kid for bedtime stories, you know. So I was just introduced to these things. And to me, it was just a love of finding out more about this stuff. I knew I wanted to do this for my life, for my work. I mean, I love painting and I love drawing, but this idea of kind of tying it all together and working with a client and actually helping them realize something that expresses them in a way that's accurate and aesthetic and efficient and does all the things that good design should do is just, it's a very satisfying profession to be in. And so I find the things in the client that would relate universally, but I still need to put in, I always put in something that's quite specific to them. So, for instance, the Arabian horse logo, you may have noticed the two, the yin-yang horses, I call them.
Yeah.
There's an empty horse and a filled horse, a positive and a negative horse, and they loop around their heads and their necks, arch around each other, and one creates the other. You know, it's like two sides of a coin. The edge has got to be there to create the two. So you've got two opposites as complements. This is what I tell my students, too. Opposites are not in contention with one another. Opposites create one another.
Right.
They're actually complements. And we have a tendency of black and white thinking in our culture. So we have this tendency to think of opposites as some sort of a conflicted situation, but it's actually not that at all. It's actually a representational situation that allows you to clearly see each. And so I use this aspect of the two horse heads for an Arabian horse farm, and because of the shape of the circle, I brought in all of these aspects of that particular breed. You know, the fact that they have very delicate bone structure, a dished face and an arched neck, and it worked perfectly to have them fit that way.
And when the client says, yes, that's who I am, then you know you've done it right.
Right. And I usually know before I go in to see the client. And I typically give at least a few different directions, but I almost always know which one it is. And sometimes without doubt know which one it is. You know, oftentimes know which one it is without doubt. The paw print with the Band-Aid for the vet. It's like, you mean someone hasn't done this yet? That was the one that won first place in the United States in 1983. And
right.
I couldn't believe that someone hadn't hit on that fable of Androcles and the lion. And by putting a Band-Aid on the paw, I mean, it's a universal thing that people in any country, any culture would understand that if they saw that hanging on someone's shingle, they'd have a very good idea of what that person did. You know, no language, no written language necessary.
Well, there's much more to talk about, but this issue of simplicity is something, I mean, that interaction, again, they're not opposites, simplicity and complexity in nature. They're kind of like two sides of the same coin.
Right, and they're both necessary. I mean, I guess you would say that complexity is connected with chaos and things not being organized, and perhaps there being some things there that are unnecessary, but it's going through, elegance is going through that process of refinement that strips away the stuff that may not be needed in that moment. That's not that stuff may not be needed later on or at another time, but right for that particular function of how it's being used, it's not necessary. And that's kind of the process I go through in the logo design of what can I strip away here? What is superfluous? What can be thrown out? And how do I create the most elegant, minimalist piece of design that still communicates? You know, Einstein said, be simple, but don't be too simple. So that's what you want to strive for in good design.
Maggie McNabb is a designer, educator, and author. Her new book is called Design by Nature, Using Universal Forms and Principles in Design, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, the 13th of January at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. What's your website?
The book's website is designbynaturebook.com.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.